This is Paul Price with Mr. Richard Masur, Oral History 1 of 3, Actors Fund, October 24th, 2016. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you.
So, I want to start off by asking you, tell me a little bit about your family and your childhood, and how did that stoke your interest in things that eventually came out in your work?
Well, first of all, since this is for the record, and I don't mean this in any way as to be critical, but my last name is pronounced Masur, which no one pronounces correctly, so you're in very good company. It's spelled M-A-S-U-R, but it sounds like M-A-S-S-E-R.
Okay.
And I always tell, once people hear that, they usually get it right from then on. So I was born in Manhattan at Doctor's Hospital, which no longer exists, on the far east side of Manhattan. We lived first for a little while in the Bronx with my grandparents on off Pelham Parkway on Wallace Avenue. And then we moved up to Yonkers, where I grew up in Yonkers, basically. We lived in an apartment, a garden apartment, and then in 1952, when I was four, my father bought a house on the GI Bill and for $14,000, and we watched it being built. We would go every once in a while and see how far they'd gotten. And because of that, my parents got to make a couple of little changes, which made the house different from some of the other houses, not on the outside, just on the inside. My father was, the people who liked me from my life and who liked my work when I'm playing a kind of thoughtful, you know, solid guy, that was my father. He was that. The people who liked the kind of more crazy, explosive stuff. Not too many in my people in my life like that, but in my work, sometimes they do. That was my mother. They were quite different. She was the most theatrical person I've ever met, and I've been working in this business for 45 years. I've never met anyone more theatrical than she was. Histrionic. Everything was larger than life. Everything that happened in the world when something would come on the radio or the television, it was just like it was all being stuck in her, you know, like a sharp blade. And so I really pushed off of that model. Not that I didn't, well, there were a lot of times when my mother and I didn't like each other, but I mean, we loved each other, but I really pushed off her as a model. And I gravitated toward my father, who was very solid. I describe my father as a big rock on the shore, just a massive rock just lowering over the water. And my mother are these huge waves that would come crashing in and cover him over. And they'd go back out to sea, and there would my father be just exactly the way he always was, not changed, not moved, not in any way affected by this storm that was crashing off him. That was very much their relationship. So my mother was, when she was a young woman, she went to Hunter College and in the 30s, and she was the captain of her sing team. You know, we don't have time for me to describe to you what a sing was or how important it was to the colleges, the women's colleges especially, in the United States at that time. But they would do these competitions where they would write songs and they would present them and they would be in teams. And the Hunter College Sing was a citywide event. It was a very big deal in New York. And my mother captained her team in her junior and senior years and won both of those years. And when she got out of college and my father got out of his master's, got out of graduate school, which was just around the same time, they both ended up at B. Altman's, which was a big department store, which now, I forget what it is now, but it's on, I'm embarrassed that I forget. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's in the 30s on Madison Avenue. Mm-hmm. And right sort of catty corner across from the, Oh, so it must be around 34th, 35th Street. A huge store like Macy's store. And my father was a stock manager because he had a master's, and my mother was a sales clerk because she only had a bachelor's. And that's what was happening in the 30s. My father had a master's in education, but he had decided that he couldn't make any money as a school teacher. He could make more money working at B. Altman. So they met there. So that was fortuitous for everybody. While they were working there, they both joined the International Ladies Garment Worker Union, the ILGWU, and my mother was in a production of a show that was written by Comden and Green, and it was a review, and other people, I think Leonard Bernstein, I don't even remember who, no, Bernstein would have been too young, but anyway, there were, I'm embarrassed again that I don't remember, but it was called Pins and Needles, and it was a show that the union put on, and in that day and age, there was a lot of that going on. There was a lot of cross-pollination between the labor movement in general and Actors' Equity and, you know, and all the Screen Actors Guild had just started out in Los Angeles. The American Federation of Radio Artists, I take it back, American Federation of Radio Artists had just started in New York a few years before. And so... So there was a lot of this cross-pollination. So my mother was in the cast of the show, Pins and Needles, that was done by the members of the labor union, of the Ladies Garment Workers Union. And they decided to move the show. It was a really big hit in the ILGWU production. And some producers decided they were going to move the show to Broadway. And my mother was one of the few people who was asked to go along, and she said no. Mark that point in time, because that was a definitive moment in her life. She said no because she was afraid. And she didn't do it. I don't know that she spent the rest of her life regretting that, but she certainly... It certainly nibbled at her every once in a while that she said no. At any rate, so I grew up in Yonkers. My parents, my mother was a school teacher, not at first, but she became a school teacher. My father was out of work for a while. He was a druggist. He was out of work for a while between drugstores. And during that time, she went back and started teaching school. And I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
I think I was around 8 or something like that. My sister was about 11.
Was she that catalyst for you to get into acting and performing?
No, not quite the opposite. When I say I pushed off her, I pushed off.
Right.
I didn't want anything to do with anything that my mother had to do with or my sister had to do with. However, what I wouldn't say it was a catalyst, but what certainly had an impact on me was she... started taking us to theater when we were very young and had no money. After she started teaching school, TDF had just started, the Theater Development Fund had just started. And my mother got involved with them and helped them create a little program where when they had extra, you know, the seats that weren't selling for a show, they would offer them to schools who would take blocks of seats, and then they would bring students. And my mother did this over and over and over again. And all through my years growing up, every once in a while we'd go and we'd see. I saw the original West Side Story. I saw the original Most Happy Fella. I saw Enter Laughing with Alan Arkin. I saw a bunch, a lot of theater, and I was quite young. Like when I saw, I don't remember the year, but I remember being so young when I saw West Side Story that I was embarrassed by the use of the word sperm, and also the officer Krupke, because it in the play they say womb to tomb, sperm to worm, and they changed it for the film. They couldn't say spoon, sperm. And I don't even think they said womb. I think they changed both of them for the film. Anyway, and so I remember I was, and Most Happy Fella, there was a rape scene in which I was so embarrassed by being with my parents seeing this.
Yeah.
I remember that as well. So that's what, how I know I was young. But what I also, my mother was a big believer that we should, that my sister and I should be able to go out of town for the summer and go to like a camp, and we didn't have the money to do it. So she knew a couple of people who were, who owned a summer camp. Mm-hmm. They were just school teachers, really, right. But this was their side business. And she talked them into letting her be the girls' head counselor, and the exchange for that was rather than paying her, we got to go to camp for free. So we went to the summer camp, and they did plays at the summer camp, and I was involved in those. But I didn't care about it. It wasn't something I ever thought I wanted to do. I wanted to go into science. I was very interested in medicine. That was really what I was interested in prior to going to college.
Tell me about your first performance experience. And
well, no, I had a lot of them in you know, as a kid, but that doesn't resonate for me as part of what happened later. What happened later started when I was in college. I was an anthropology major by this time. And I went in my freshman year, I went with a friend of mine, a guy named Jimmy Kennedy, who was going to audition for a production of Our Town at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where I was in college. And I went with him, and whoever, I can't remember who was directing it. I think it was a woman named Vicky Gadella, who was an exchange graduate student from England. And, well, she wasn't exchange, she was just from England. And anyway, I just walked over with him one snowy night. I was probably a little loaded. And I sat in the back of the theater, which was tiny. It was actually built in a little room off the gym, which was built as a wrestling room, a wrestling competition room. But they suddenly turned around, they realized they didn't have a theater because the school was brand new. And they just made that into the theater. They have a beautiful theater now. It's Stony Brook. Anyway, when everybody was finished, she looks up at me, and I looked not dissimilar to the way I look now. I was big, I had long hair, not this long, but long hair, and a beard, a kind of scruffy little 19-year-old beard, or 18-year-old beard. And the director said, "You want to audition?" I said, "No, not really." And he said, "Come on, read the milkman for me, this guy Howie Newsom." So I read, and she gave me the part. So I did that show, and then I got to know a bunch of the people mm-hmm. who were interested in the theater and involved in the theater, including faculty. And then I got cast in another show, and I was always playing, or mostly playing, the older guy, you know, because I had a relatively deep voice and I was big, and you know, and I was solid. I was my father, you know. I was like a big tree, and people believed me as an older person. So, and I did that long enough so that I ended up ignoring the rest of my other studies and bailing out of everything, anthropology, everything, and just becoming a theater major. And when I became a theater major, my advisor, who was one of two faculty in the theater department, we had a really tiny theater department. It was just absurd that they even had a major in theater. I said to him, "You know, there's no place for me to go now but out." You know, I went from pre-med to anthropology, so science, social science, arts. I gotta leave. That's my next move, is to get out of here. And I did. That's exactly what happened. And it wasn't because I wanted to be an actor. It was because I didn't know what else I wanted to do, and I thought I should find out, because I kind of like this stuff. I mean, there was a moment on stage in a play that we did, a Sean O'Casey play called The Silver Tassie. TASSIE, which I never will forget that moment. I was playing a man who was, well, I was one of three men who went off to fight the First World War, and then there's this horrible scene in the war, and then the next scene is the guy who was the star of this football team, this soccer team, has lost both his legs, and he's a cripple, and he was like the king of the world before we went off, and I've been blinded, and I have an unfaithful wife, and knew I had an unfaithful wife, and now there's nothing I can do about it because I'm a blind man. And but because I'm blinded, she becomes faithful to me, which is really quite interesting. But anyway, I come in at the beginning of this scene. She leads me in. It's the first time you see me as a blind man. And she starts to describe the room. And I say, no, I know, or something like that. And I talk about the colors that are in the room and the kinds of balloons and how it all looks. And I remember doing this and experiencing the reality of being a blind person, which had never happened to me before and has rarely happened to me since, where I became the thing I was supposed to be rather than seeming to be the thing that I was supposed to be. It's my opinion, and for me this is true, and I think it's true for many, many, many actors, most actors, probably on some level all actors. Our job is not to be real. Our job is to create verisimilitude, which means the appearance of truth. Mm-hmm. It's not, if we had to be what we're supposed to be, then you just go and cast those people to play those roles, and actors would have no jobs. But the fact is, I get to play a lot of different things because I'm capable, when I'm doing my job well, I'm capable of seeming to be who I tell you I am and what I tell you I am. You don't have to believe I'm actually that. You only have to believe that that's how I seem. And that, we go on that journey together. And, and even somebody who is as committed to his work and as all in as someone like Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, for example, he wasn't actually mauled by a bear. I don't care how much we believed it. He wasn't. He didn't actually sew up his own body. But he convinced us that he did. And that's acting. It's not about, but every once in a while you have these transient moments, and they're transient in that they just flash through. But they're also kind of transcendent at the same time, where something happens where it's true. It's just, it's absolute, you are believing it as much as they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a rare experience. And what I learned after that experience in college was, you can't spend your life looking for those because you will be disappointed and you will fail over and over again. You have to set your sights on verisimilitude. If you set your sights on truth, you are dooming yourself to be frustrated and angry and unhappy. And I know many of these people in this business, some of whom are successful, but most of whom are not at all successful because they can't get over their own expectations of what they should be able to do. And no one can do that. You just can't. Every once in a while you get this little gift where it settles on you like a, I don't know, I'm going to get cliched, but really like a piece of spider web just drifting down and falling on your shoulders, and you just go, oh my gosh. But you can't spend your time expecting that and hunting that.
So tell me a little bit about what's your process as an actor when you get a script that demands the completeness of yourself? How do you approach that?
Well, first of all, most of us living in the 20th and 21st century don't get that opportunity very often. We don't get that material. We don't material of that quality, and we don't get that particular role, even if the material is of that quality. I have spent my life as a yeoman character actor. I show up and I create a person who I believe is as close as possible to the person that the piece requires, that the director requires, and that my fellow actors require. And so my process is whatever is required to get to that is what I go through. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's you feed off there's a note about the fact that, like, for example, I did a film several years ago called The Believers, and in this film, the guy was a magician, an amateur magician. He was really an attorney. And John Schlesinger was the director, great man, great director. And I asked him why he made him a... And when I was talking to him about the role, I said, I'm not a magician, I got to tell you, but... And he was very interested in me, so I felt comfortable in telling him the truth. And I said, why did you give him this little... Because it doesn't... And he said, you know what, because the whole piece is about magic, but, you know, what we think of as dark magic, as you know, like Santeria, I mean, what people who don't understand it think of that way, and that's the point of view from which the film was taken. And he said he thought it would be wonderful to weave sleight of hand into this mix. Mm-hmm. And he said also when he was a young man, he was an amateur magician. And when he was in the service during the Second World War, his job, because they knew I was clearly useless as a soldier, they sent him around to entertain the children of troops and stuff like that doing magic. So he sent me to meet and to be trained by a man named Ricky Jay, who I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but look him up. Ricky Jay is probably the greatest living magician in the United States. He's certainly the greatest living student of magic. He's an extraordinary sleight of hand artist and an extraordinary... there are several movies that have been made about him. He's worked as an actor in almost every one of David Mamet's films also. Anyway, so I went to Ricky, and Ricky was about to do David's first film. And we kind of bartered, and he taught me a little bit of how to look like I knew how to do magic, and I taught him a little bit of how to look like he could act. And he could act. He's a great performer. So all it was don't go past that. Don't look for something outside yourself. You can draw all of this from inside yourself. So I gave him that, which is, in my experience, mostly always true for me as well. I get that. Most of the people that I've been in film, the reason I brought up The Believers, and because I didn't know how to do magic, so I had a job I had to do. I had to go and I had to practice, and I practiced every day, and we shot stuff. And then my biggest, you know, when I did well, I pulled it off to look comfortable with cards, making fans with cards, and just doing, you know, the things I would watch Ricky do. Was he would talk to me. He just fan these cards and shuffle them together, and he'd do this as he was talking to me. So I did this in scenes with Martin Sheen, who was my friend in the movie, and with his son. And at one point, I take a cigarette and I do this disappearing cigarette trick where you stuff it into your hand, and then you go like that, and it's gone. And I worked so hard to learn how to do this trick, and I actually could do it. I mean, I could actually do it credibly. Not great, but credibly. And we went to shoot it, and we shot it. And then when I saw the movie, John Schlesinger, the amateur magician, cut exactly at the key moment to another angle and then back, which you never do on a magic trick, because then, well, you didn't really do it, because it's in two different shots. And I came to him after the screening, the casting crew screening. I said, how could you cut in the middle of the trick? He said, you know, I actually never thought of that, Richard. I'm so sorry. I said, I worked so hard to learn how to do it. Anyway, but that's what I'm talking about with verisimilitude, because most people who are watching that, to them, I did the trick. They bought it. They believed I knew how to do it, you know, and that's what we do in film. That's what we do in television. That's what we do in theater. We say, come here, I want to tell you something. Let's go for a ride. And if you agree, we'll do it together. Yeah. If you don't, there's almost nothing I can do that's going to get you there, or anybody else can do that's going to get you there, because what we were doing is not really what we're telling you we're doing. So, but in like one more quick example, I show up, I'm doing this, it was a movie for television, John Steinbeck's story, one of his lesser novels, called The Winter of Our Discontent. And it's a really good book, but it's not one of the great Steinbeck books. And no one had ever done a film of this, so it was the first time it was being done as any kind of film. So we did a TV movie, and Donald Sutherland was playing the lead in it. And it was his first television movie. He'd done many films, but this was his first television movie. So I'm playing his best friend, who is this kind of ne'er-do-well, drunk, rich boy who he grew up with. Sutherland was a poor kid, but we were always pals, and now we're both in our 40s, and my life has turned to absolute shambles. So has his, but he has an idea for how to get out of this problem that he has and how to salvage his life, and I'm out of hope, but I love him. So it's too long to go into, but basically the thing is this. We have the first 3 days of the film, it's just the two of us. We've never met. I come up there early in the afternoon, the day before we're shooting. I'm told that Sutherland is on the way and that we're going to meet up. We're going to have dinner together. We're going to get some time. They have to do some hair and makeup and wardrobe with him, but there'll be plenty of time for the two of us to spend a little time together, get to know each other at least a little bit before we shoot the next morning. And when I get there, I find out that he's had a tragedy, which that his father has just died. And his father, who wasn't living with him, who's been in a nursing home in Las Vegas, and with whom he wasn't all that close in recent years, from what I was told anyway, but he died, and Sutherland was coming from Montreal, where he lived, and he changed his plans, and he flew to Las Vegas, and then he was coming up to Carmel, California, where we were, which was the base from which we were working, and he didn't get in till almost 11:30 at night. I literally never even said hello to him. They just whisked him into hair and makeup. His hair was snow white, and they had to dye it and cut it, and he had a big beard. They had to take it off. They had to go through wardrobe with him, and he was like a wreck. So 7 o'clock in the morning, he's in makeup, I'm in makeup. We still haven't met. We actually meet on the beach where we're doing our first scene. And the scene is, I'm talking to him as his oldest friend in the world and about something, I don't even remember what. And then I say, come on, let's go skinny dipping like we always do on this cove on the 17-mile drive. And it's really cold water in this area. So we're sitting there and we're, you know, and we do a take, you know, and we're doing the front part of the scene before, and I like jump up out of the shot, and then we do coverage, and it's really, really fast, and there aren't a whole lot of takes because we don't have time for that. And he's in this fog, and he says, so that's it? That's all we're... I said, yeah, that's it. You know, we just... If we get the words out in the right order and we don't actively, you know, trip over our gonads on the way, it's a take, you know. And I mean, it's a print, and we're going to move on. So we then start... We go to this scene where I come, and I jump up, as I'm jumping up, I'm pulling down my shorts, and I'm running to the water, and I go in the water, and I, you know, cover it up, and I go, come on, let's go, you know, I'm waiting for him, then he's supposed to come out, do the same thing, come in. So we do me a few times, because, you know, we just want to make sure everything's working, and it's really cold in the water, and when you hit the water, it's like, you know, one of those, but it's okay. So, and while we're sitting there, forgot to mention, while we're sitting there, we see this big harbor seal comes popping up out of the water about 100 feet out from the shore, his head. And I'm very relaxed to see the seal, because if there are seals there, it means there are no sharks. Because if there are sharks, the seals are going to be gone, or they're going to be out of the water. So that's relaxing me a little. That's kind of freaking Donald out a little. I'm explaining this to him. And then, so we do it where I go in and I go, come on, come on. And I'm swimming out and I'm backstroking out. And he comes in and he comes running in, and the water, as he starts getting deeper in the water, he just loses his air. And because he's this big, he's really thin. And he hits the water and he starts swimming, you know, like in a really jerky way. And I swim over to him because he's having trouble, and he grabs hold of me, and I know he's freaking out. And then I realize that we're moving out much faster than we should be because we're not swimming anymore. And I realize we're in a riptide at this point. So I just put my arms up like that. He's hanging on to me. I say, cut it, cut it. We're coming in. And I turn him around and I start dragging him in. And I said, Donald, you got to work with me. You got to help me here. So we end up, we get in. And I said, now we got it. We got everything we needed. But it was really, really scary. And then I turn around and I look back out and there's no seals to be seen. And I'm really, really glad to be out of the water, because this is great white sharks hunt along this coast all the time. And he's making noise like a dying fish with his legs and arms. I mean, it's like, you know. Anyway, but here's the point of the story. We played this scene, we played the next 3 days, all 3 days, as these people who had known each other our whole lives. And when we finished, he and I did not exchange a single word. And there was some other really emotional events that happened, because he has to find me dead. And because of what was going on with his father, he was having a lot of trouble getting there emotionally. So at one point, I whispered a little something to him, which triggered him. And he just blew up and he started crying and sobbing and went on with the scene. But it was unusable because it was too real. It was too much. And then we went back and did it again. And once he had unplugged the cork, he didn't have to really do that anymore. He could then seem like he was crying and play the scene. And it was a great scene. But that's how this stuff works. When we finish everything, we go out to dinner that night. And it's literally the first chance we've talked about something that didn't have to do with the scene. And he says to me, Richard, I don't know how I would have done this had you not been here. I said, thank you. He said, no, I mean that. He said, how were you able to be my best friend like this? How were you able to do that? I said, that's what I do for a living, Donald. I'm that person. So I'm his best friend. I'm Jack Nicholson's best friend in another movie. I'm, you know, this one and that one. I'm the person I'm supposed to be, because that's my job now. When you say, what's your process? I don't know what my process is. I'm watching you and thinking, what's my yang to your yin? What's my yin to your yang? How do we fit together? What, you want that too, director? Okay, let me see if I can weave that in. I don't know. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I don't think of this as an art. I'm going to just say that flat out. To me, this is a craft. You know, we artists create something from nothing. We craft something out of material we've been handed, with someone having a third eye on what we're doing and saying, that looks a little misshapen, or, that misshapenness is useful and beautiful in a weird way. Let's explore that. It's a collaboration. So, and yeah, are we creating art? Yes, we're creating art together. But my job is a craftsman's job. I believe that's what we all do. Again, other people don't have to agree with that. I'm fine with that. But I've never been, you know, it was never my calling. It was never, I was going to die if I wasn't an actor. And for me, one final story about all this. My agent, who was my agent for over 40 years, from the day we met till the day she died, the first time we sat down together to talk, she had already negotiated my first contract for me, which is a story I'll tell you at another time. And we're sitting in her office. She said, come in and let's talk. Because I said, should I sign with you? And she said, let's talk first and see. You know, I'm happy to do this one thing, but let's talk and see. And she said, what do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? I said, I'd like to be able to make my living as an actor without having to do something else to supplement it. She said, that seems like a possibly achievable goal. She said, and what would make you feel like you were a success? And I said, well, number one, if I could do that. And number two, if someone were willing to wait 3 days for me. Like, if I couldn't be there exactly when they needed me, if they could go, oh, okay, look, we'll switch things around and we'll make it work. Then I would think, oh man, now I'm a success. And I got that. I had that multiple times. And it's from the day I did my first paid job as an actor to today, I've never done anything else for a living. And that's, well, that was the first paid job was in 72. So that's 44 years.
Yeah. Wow.
And there are not a lot of us. I mean, there are not a lot of us. Of the 10 of us who are doing this right now, I think a few of us have done that, but I think there are a few people who have been doing this their whole lives and are absolutely professional actors and have been able to hang in there by doing other things. I haven't had to do that.
Yeah.
And that's been, and I'm incredibly grateful for that on the one hand, and also feel incredibly lucky. I was in the right place at the right time to do some of the things I got to do. What people are looking for nowadays in what was, would have been my age range when I came into the business in my 20s, I was the wrong guy to be doing what they're doing nowadays. I was the right guy to be doing what we were doing then. Mm-hmm. So
how do you feel, let's just come in off of that, how do you feel now about critics and the media and their, you know, so many pundits now like assessing film and television, and where do you feel that, how does that affect you and your work? You have such a long career, and what's your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I'm seldom in the firing line when critics are going. I mean, the first Broadway show I ever did was a show called The Changing Room, written by a man named David Story. He's a great British playwright. And we had like 10, 11 reviews at that time. There were that many papers and publications in New York, and they were all raves. And I was not mentioned in any of them, which was okay. It was a 21-person cast. And there were some, you know, there were some kind of breakout characters, which, you know, that you expected those people to be mentioned. One was John Lithgow. That was his breakthrough performance. He won the Tony for supporting actor for that. Anyway, a man named Vincent Canby, who was a big, big New York Times critic and also writer of feature stories. And he was doing less criticism, but every once in a while, when he really wanted to, he wrote a review. And he wrote a review of Changing Room, which he loved. And he picked two people out of the cast. One was John Lithgow, and I was the other. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. The fact that he saw me meant a lot to me. And then, which meant a thing which, you know, on the face of it meant way more, Norman Lear came to see that show. Another little story, which I'll leave on the side for now because I'm taking up too much time with this. But Norman came to see the show, and the next day they asked me to come in and meet Norman, and I had no idea who he was, why I was going. My agent goes, have you ever heard of a show called All in the Family? I said, yes. She said, have you ever heard of a show called Sanford and Son? And I said, yes. And she said, well, those are his shows, and, you know, he's a very big deal in television. He wants to meet you. Why are you giving me trouble about this? So I went and met with him, and he had seen me in Changing Room, and he was thinking about spinning two characters off of All in the Family. There was a character that Betty Garrett played, who was a great, great American film actress and singer and dancer. I mean, she was the whole package. She was just great. And a wonderful actor named Vincent Cardenio also. And they were their next door neighbors of the Bunkers. And they were a role reversed couple in the 70s, where he was into cooking and was always wearing an apron and stuff. And she was always like under sinks fixing plumbing and doing carpentry and stuff like that. And he wanted to spin them off, and he wanted me to play their son, who had been completely estranged out because of these two people. And I don't think he knew more than that at that point. That's the way Norman was, very kind of improvisational in his thinking. And he fell in love with people, and I was very lucky. Norman fell in love with me. I fell in love with him. And then the pilot didn't happen, but the point was he came to the changing room. And so those two things are, you know, you asked about critics, mm-hmm. but those were really major moments. I'll tell you another critic story, mm-hmm. okay? I was shooting a TV movie, which was a really big deal for me. I was playing the lead, which I didn't do very often. And I was playing the lead because nobody else wanted to play it because it was a pedophile. Mm-hmm. And he was a very, very wonderful man who also was a pedophile. So it was ugly and scary and weird. He wasn't a creepy guy. He was a really nice guy. He was the best guy this little girl had ever met. And he recruited kids for child pornography, as well as being a pedophile. It was a movie called Fallen Angel, and it's a terrific, terrific piece. Anyway, we were shooting that in L.A., and I had done a movie a year before, a little film called Heaven's Gate. Now, Heaven's Gate was one of the famous Hollywood catastrophes from the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Michael Cimino had just won the Academy Award for Deer Hunter. He had a $17 million film, which turned into a $34 million film after he won the Oscar. Then, before we started shooting, it went up to a $38 million film, and then as we were shooting, it snowballed over $50 million. It was bigger than any movie that had ever been imagined in terms of cost. But it was also, we all thought we were making the great American Western, that we were going to revive the genre, I went, finally I'm going to be in a movie that everybody in the world is going to see. And this thing opens while I'm shooting Fallen Angel. I can't go to the opening in New York. It opens in a small theater on the East Side. And Michael was so crazy at that point. He didn't let anybody see it. He didn't let his friends see it. He didn't let other directors see it. He didn't let the studio see it. He didn't let the critics see it. It opened cold, and every critic who walked into this movie, because the critics were all there at the opening in this little theater, so it was mostly them. They were furious when they sat down, because they had to write their reviews for the dailies. Their reviews were supposed to be in the next morning, so they had to go and watch this 3.5-hour movie and then go and write a review of this, and they slaughtered it. They killed it. Canby, this time, destroyed it. I mean, they killed it. I said it was horrible, such a waste of time, unbelievably self-indulgent, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I come in the next morning, and I've been called that night by my wife, who is my ex-wife now. She was in New York, and she called me up, and she read me the review, and I almost threw up. I thought, oh, my God. And then it was one after another, the Hollywood Reporter, Daily Variety, Newsweek, Time. It was the snowball of horrible, horrible reviews. Now, again, I'm not anywhere on anybody's radar, because there was so much else to hate and to pick on in this movie. But I thought, you know, this is a moment. I've been in some films that I thought, okay, this will be good, but nothing like Heaven's Gate. So I'd walk onto the set and I'm just dragging, and there, somebody says, the director says to me, what's the matter? And I said, well, this movie Heaven's Gate I made, it just opened and just got killed. And I thought, he said, Richard, if the movie is a gigantic hit, you know, a few million people are going to see it. This is before everybody had video and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. A few million people are going to see it. He said, this 25, 30 million people are going to see it. Don't worry about that. And he was right. Now, as it turned out, you know, I don't know if you know the story of Heaven's Gate. They forced Michael to go back and recut it and cut it down to 2 hours and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was horrible. I mean, it was the worst possible version you could have made of the film he shot. And then sometime later, they let him restore the original cut, do a couple of other things to it. And that's the version that exists. Now, what it is it's a magnificent failure. It's still the best work that Vilmos Zsigmond ever did. He was the cinematographer. It's the most extraordinary looking film. There are great performances by many people. There are some extraordinarily memorable moments, but it doesn't quite work. It's not horrible. It's self-indulgent, or it's indulgent in certain ways at certain times, but a lot of it is just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And people who have reviewed it since have said this about the film. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's like, so what are you going to do? There's nothing you can do. I mean, that's the sum total of the story. One guy loves you, nothing happens, something else, you know, somebody happens to show up at your play and your career gets kicked up a notch, and you go and work in television for the next 25 years, you know, I mean, because of Norman.
Yeah, the business is so unpredictable like that. You never know what's going to be your entry point, right?
Exactly. But what's going to mean something? What's going to make the difference? And what I finally came to was I'm a long distance runner. I'm not a sprinter. That's me. I just keep doing it. And if I can just keep doing it until I can't do it anymore, that's what I'm going to do. I mean, if they'll let me. So that's always, you know, and recently I've just had a lot of lovely stuff happen, and I didn't expect it, but...
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, I came back here to live after being living in California for 26 years. I came back here in 2001, and it was, I largely came back here because the woman I was seeing after our marriage, and my marriage to my first wife broke up, the woman I was seeing, who's now my wife, Eileen Henry, she was based here, and she came out there with me a couple of times for 2 or 3 months, and she just hated it, and I didn't want, and I thought, hey, I've been doing this for 30-something years, they all know me. It's not going to make a difference. I was working my butt off for years. So I came back here, and no, that wasn't the case. It was like, I had to go in and read for little roles in movies I wouldn't have even shown up for, a year before. I was, and this wasn't out of a sense of, grandiosity. This was just not the pattern that I'd lived in my career. People knew me. They'd come in and, you know, I'd be treated with respect. Usually I'd come in and I'd have a conversation with them and they'd make up their minds based on that. But, you know, and occasionally I would read, and sometimes I get it and sometimes I wouldn't. But this was like debilitating. And then a script was sent to me for a play. And I liked it, but I was really nervous. I hadn't done a play in 30 years. In 25 plus years. And I was nervous. I didn't know, could I sustain the performance? Could I remember the lines? Could I? So luckily I got a little bridge thing, which was, they were doing this thing called The Exonerated, which was this wonderful show about people on death row who were exonerated because they were actually innocent. And the setup of the show, Bob Balaban directed it, and it was a really lovely setup. There were like a bunch of music stands. We all sat on stools, and then then there were two or like five of the characters were in all the time, or maybe six. And then there were basically three characters, four characters sometimes, that rotated in and out. And they would job people in. And like the character who opened the show, the guy who opened the show in my character was Tim Robbins. I hate when this happens.
Delroy Lindo, by chance?
No, it wasn't Delroy. Oh my gosh, I can't stand it when this happens. Anyway, so I did it, a huge range of people did it, but I did it about four or five times over the course of, like I did 2 weeks here, went away, came back, did 2 weeks. And because it was a reading, you know, because I had a script in front of me, it took a little of that anxiety away. And but by the third night, I was off book. I was doing it without the book. And when I came back the next time, I was just really comfortable doing it. And I, you know, when I explored, and I did all the stuff you do when you're doing a show on stage. And that was a treat, because I hadn't done that in a long time. I directed in the theater, but I hadn't acted in the theater. So this other thing, this thing called Sarah came along, lovely piece, written by a man named Daniel Goldfarb, which was being done at the Manhattan Theater Club up at City Center. So I went in to meet with them on this, and it was two roles. It was the first act was I was playing a Polish man. And with a, you know, from, you know, an emigre to Canada, actually. In the second, one, I was playing the grown-up young boy who was in the first act, who had a daughter who was played by a woman named J. Smith Cameron, who's a wonderful theater actor, who was playing this woman for whom I worked in the first act, and the mother of the boy that I was now playing. She was now playing my daughter. And anyway, so it was a real challenge, and I was really nervous. And I showed up on the first day, and I had the entire first act cold and the second act memorized, though it wasn't cold. But I had it memorized. And by the end of the first week, I was cold on the whole play. Everybody else is walking around with their scripts in their hands, and I'm leaving my script on the side, and I'm, because I have a lot of props I have to deal with. And Jay, at one point, she just goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, please don't take this personally. I'm not trying to be a big smart guy or anything like that. I am so frightened, and you do this stuff all the time. So you're not, but I'm really frightened. I have to do this. I have to be off book. I have to know that I'm safe off book. I have to just trust me." And from that day until this, and I've done many plays over the last 14, 15 years being back here. From that day until this, I approach it with the exact same sense of panic and terror. I show up with my words. I don't. Because let me tell you something, and I don't know who else is going to tell you guys the same story. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I could pick up a script and go, blah, 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 okay, let's go. And I'm good. I mean, I was in the ballpark on most of it. If I wasn't exactly word perfect, I knew the scene. And usually I was pretty close. And if I worked on it a little bit and got cued, I was great. Then when I get into my 40s and my 50s, all of a sudden I got to work a lot harder. And by then I'm with a woman, my ex-wife, who was really bored with cueing me. So I found this little digital recorder. Well, first a tape recorder and then a digital recorder. I would record my cues and my lines, and that's how I learned lines. And I come to find out that this is actually medically true, that as you get older, your visual memory becomes weaker and your auditory memory becomes strong, or in comparison becomes stronger. So learning things by rote is a much better technique if you're getting older. So that's what I do now, and I'm good at it. I, when I do film and TV work and stuff, I'm almost never the guy who screws the scene up because of words. When I'm on stage, I'm almost never the guy who goes up. Almost never. I mean, fingers of one, two hands, all the work I've done. And that's great. I'm very proud of that, but I'm also grateful because I can't... Final story on this. A friend of mine, and I'm not going to mention the actor's name because he's a very famous actor, but a friend of mine was very good friends with a very famous actor, and she went over to England, and he was doing a play in the West End, and she came to see him after the show, after she saw the show, and he's in taking a shower. She's sitting in the dressing room waiting for him, and she's looking at a script, and in his script, there are all these marks in the script. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with a slash across, so it's all these tick marks with slashes and fives in different colors next to many of the lines. So he comes out and she says, "What is this stuff? I'm just curious." He said, "Oh, well, before I go out every night, I go through all my words. And if I hesitate or I make a mistake, I go back and I do it 5 times before I move on." Now, this was a big deal actor. And she said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, you know what? Because I can't do my work if I'm looking for the lines. Unless they're just there, I can't do my work." I didn't learn this until I had to be perfectly honest. Because there was a time when I could do my work without looking for them, but I can't anymore because I don't want to make a mistake. And also when you're young, it doesn't matter what you do. You can screw up as much as you want and then laugh it off. But when I show up, people expect me to be the guy. You know, they expect me to... I'm not going to be some screw-up. I've been doing this for over 40 years. I can't go in there and go, "Oh, hell, I don't know, whatever." You know, I can't do it. So I feel a lot of pressure about... Not only that, but about setting an example for younger people that they need to take this, not take it seriously, but they need to treat it professionally and be ready to go when they get there. And I've only had 2 experiences in my whole career where I stumbled on a film or a TV set in a way where we had to go over something repeatedly, and they were incredibly humiliating experiences for me. And I don't ever want to repeat them. And they were, in both cases, they were humiliating because the people with whom I was working were humiliating me because of my having a problem, which is on them if I choose to put it on them. But I take it on myself because it's up to me to show up and be prepared. And even if I have a problem, if I haven't done everything in the world possible to make sure that I'm not going to have a problem, then it's my fault. It's on me. And even if they act badly, it's on me. So, I mean, and that's the kind of criticism, looping back to criticism, that's the stuff I really take on. When somebody looks at me sideways and say, "What's going on with you? What's wrong with you today? Are you having a problem or something?" That undoes me. It really undoes me. Because like most of the actors I've known in my life, we all think we're frauds. We all expect to be found out at any moment. We're all terrified of the moment when he finds me out or she finds me out or they find me out. And you can't get talked out of that. You have to live through these and go, "Yeah, okay, I know that now. Not going to put myself in that situation again." So when I say I work terrified on stage, I mean I have a healthy level of fear of screwing up, which motivates me to do my work well. And I, you know, I'm a solid guy. I've been doing solid work for a long time and a lot of different things, a lot of range. Had a woman come up to me yesterday after a screening, and she just went on and on. And she said, "You are an institution. You've been just everything you've done, you know, it doesn't matter how small it is, how big it is, you add value to the work that I see you in always. And to me, again, that's part of what I'm shooting for. I'm, you know, like I said, my job is show up and do what they need to make it work. And most of the time I do that.
Okay. Yeah. So before we end, can you tell me a little bit about your
Mr. President
okay. Very sign quickly. Here?
So I was the national president of the Screen Actors Guild, and the day after the election, I got a FedEx from a friend of mine who lived in New York, and I was living in California, and in it was a little box. I took out the box, and it was a little brass, well, actually it was aluminum, but it was a little holder, and I didn't bring that because it was too much to schlep, with a sign in it that said, Mr. President, and I had it on my desk the whole time I was president of the union. It was very sweet, and when I was voted out of there, which is a huge long story, which I'll tell you another time, the only thing I took with me was this. You know, and I thought I came in with it. I'm taking it with me when I go. So, anyway, thank you.
Good. Thank you so much.